Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of December 6th. This week we were joined by the documentary filmmaker Morgan Atkinson, who talked with us about his new documentary called Uncommon Vision, The Life and Times of John Howard Griffin. John Howard Griffin was the author of the book Black Like Me, and also a friend of Thomas Merton and a convert to Catholicism. The documentary will air in January on Kentucky PBS. It is also available for purchase on Morgan Atkinson's website.
My first question is just, maybe you could just introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us about what drew you to the story of John Howard Griffin.
Okay, well, I'm Morgan Atkinson. I'm based in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm a producer here and have been producing independent work for about 25 years now. And a lot of my work deals with people or groups that are involved in spiritual searches of some sort. One of the last works I did two or three years ago was on the life of Thomas Merton. In researching Merton and in talking with people who knew him, you know, sometimes they would say, well, what's your next project? And I really didn't have one in mind at the time. And they said, well, you know, John Howard Griffin was a good friend of Merton's, and you ought to look into his life. He had a very interesting life. And the more I learned about him, and the more I learned there was so much more to his life than his famous book, Black Like Me, the more I became sold on the idea.
Well, that transitions well to my next question is, though John Howard Griffin is known best as the author of this book, Black Like Me, which we will talk about, his life, there were so many things that he did in his life. Maybe you could just kind of give us a brief introduction.
John Griffin, or John Howard Griffin, is most well known, if he's remembered at all, for his book, Black Like Me. But that sort of hides the other remarkable aspects of his life. I mean, here was a guy who grew up in a middle-class family. His dad was a grocer. His mother was a piano teacher in Fort Worth, Texas. And at age 15, young John decides that he needs to have a broader education than he's getting. And so somehow he wrangles an invitation or a scholarship to attend a French school, a school in Tours, France. And this is a kid that's 15 years old. It's 1935, and just on his own, he makes this work out. And off by himself, he goes to France. And he does very well in school there, and at age 19 is admitted to med school in France, and then World War II breaks out. And one way or another, he finds himself working or fighting with the French resistance, the underground. And what he and some friends were trying to do was help smuggle Jewish children out of France to safe havens. And they were, they didn't have a vast underground going, but they had a small operation that was being successful. And then the Germans got on to him, and he had to flee France himself. And he went on and fought in the South Pacific for the Americans. During that fighting, a bomb goes off near him, and the concussion from the bomb caused him to go blind in about a year's time. And so suddenly this very active, vibrant guy is blind. But he adapts to that and becomes a writer. And aside from also being a successful rancher, all this while being blind. And then 10 years passes, and he's published a successful book or two, and suddenly, for unexplained reasons at the time, his eyesight comes back. And for him it was really confounding, because he had adapted so well to being blind, to suddenly have sight again was really difficult. He wrote that in many ways it was more difficult to return to the sighted world than it had been to lose his sight. But he did adapt, as he did so well throughout his life, and became a world-class photographer. He said that anyone that has been blind and then regains their sight realizes that every vision is a miracle. But it was soon after he regained sight, about 2 years afterwards, that he started the Black Like Me journey, in which he traveled through the South for 6 weeks disguised as a black man.
Well, I would say that one of the themes of your documentary and of his life was just his willingness to take great risks, whether it was in Nazi France or when he was back in the segregated South, or, as you mentioned, the Pacific as well. What was it about him that kind of prompted such courage, where he was willing to try things like going into the segregated South, essentially, looking like a black man?
Well, it seems throughout his life, one of the themes is that he was searching for or wanting to make contact with that sort of spark, or I guess you could call it a divine spark that unites us all. And he was always, I doubt he would have expressed it that way at 15, but he was searching for ultimate truths. And so I think at age 15, what prompted him to take this great risk and go to France all on his own was just this hunger for greater truths, for more ultimate truths. He also had a great love for music, and I think that was part of also one of the other themes in his life, which was this desire to find the universal order or harmony, for lack of a better way of saying it. And he would find that. He had a tremendous love for classical music, Beethoven, Brahms, Chopin. And, in that music, he could find this sense of order and harmony. He found it in great writing. He found it in, great, great spiritual thinking. And, it disturbed him in our ordinary day-to-day life that, that's so often severely lacking. And so I think he kept striving for that, or pushing for that. And much like Merton, one of the things that define them and I think make them so remarkable is that they never settled to just become complacent and comfortable. They were always sort of pushing further, where a lot of us, myself, if I find a good resting place, I'm going to rest there for a while probably, but Griffin, like Merton, would just keep pushing for deeper insights.
Yeah, another theme, I think, is empathy, his ability to, I think, really personified in the act he took by going and living in the South as a black man. Was there something about his blindness that gave him that added degree of empathy for the other?
Well, one of the insights that he had it somewhat when he was blind, but then when he regained his sight, he felt it even more deeply, is that when he was blind, he would speak to a wide variety of human beings, just had to accept them on just the way they were reacting to him. He couldn't judge them or the things they were saying. He could not judge them by appearance, whether they were black, white, attractive, or whatnot. And so he really would judge people by the essence of what they were. And he saw that so often the vast majority of us factor in all these other things that really don't have a whole lot to do with the ultimate value of the individual, but they are our prejudices. And some are sort of mild, and some are more deep-seated and more evil.
You quote one of what strikes me as one of the unique insights that he had in Black Like Me, which is that the whole segregated system was based on sight, was based on the idea that we would judge people by the way we look. And as somebody who had lost the gift of sight, he saw what a fraud that was.
Yes, exactly. And he was just appalled at the prejudices he saw in others, and also he saw in himself. He felt, like many of us, he patted himself on the back at times and thought that he had reached a certain level of acceptance and, had gotten beyond some of his ingrained prejudices. And then there would be incidents that would bring him up short and make him realize that he was still separating himself from from other humans just by the way they looked or aspects of their appearance.
Now, what drew him to the Catholic Church in particular? He was obviously not born in the faith. Was it his time in France or he had contacts with monks as well, correct?
Yes, I think his attraction to the Catholic faith sort of snuck up on him. He was first attracted to Gregorian chant because when he was going to medical school in France as a young man, he was like 19 or 20, he worked in an insane asylum where the lead researcher there was using Gregorian chant to help people who had become almost unreachable by other methods. And somehow the chant soothed people and really transformed them. And this fascinated Griffin, but not so much that he was going to intentionally go much beyond just that, well, isn't that an interesting insight? And then as he found that he was going blind, his interest in learning more about Gregorian chant deepened, and he arranged to go to the great seat of Gregorian chant in France, the Abbey of Salem, and the monks allowed him to come there and study. When he first got there, he very much thought of himself as a man of science and that he just wanted to learn more about this music so he could say he was a musicologist and that as a blind man that would be one way that he would sort of make his living. But the longer he spent around the monks, the more he was just fascinated by these men who he respected intellectually and also for their character. And just as months went on, he found that he was more attracted to the way they were living than his study of the chant. And then he began to read deeply in the Church Fathers and writings on monasticism and the spiritual life. And he reached a point where he, had this conversion experience where he uttered what he called the great yes. I mean, for all his younger life, he had been saying no, no, no to any thought of religion or spirituality. But there was something about his experience there at the monastery that changed his mind and changed his life. And he became a very devout Catholic.
And yes, and you mentioned, of course, his relationship with Thomas Merton. They shared many interests, as you indicated in the documentary, including photography, but also kind of this desire to keep pushing themselves. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about that in the spiritual life.
Merton and Griffin had a very deep friendship. It was based on the fact that they were both converts to Catholicism. They both loved the French life. I mean, Merton was born in France, and Griffin had spent so many years there, so they had that as a connection. They loved photography, and Griffin helped Merton develop his skills in photography to a very high level. But one of the real common bonds, I think they both shared it. Well, again, and also they both had a deep passion for social justice, but they were two peas in a pod when it came to pushing the boundaries, pushing the frontiers of their belief. They would not just settle into sort of conventional accepted truisms. I mean, and it wasn't like they were, quote-unquote, thrill seekers just looking for anything new and novel, but they both were mystical in their sense that they felt that the ultimate truth really could not be written down neatly and patly and very conveniently, that you sort of had to search for those on your own through contemplation and through this, this very serious approach to a spiritual life.
Now, of course, Merton died fairly early, and John Howard Griffin was his first authorized biographer. What was it about engaging Merton's work that kind of added a new layer or a new depth to his spirituality?
Well, one of the it was a mixed bag for Griffin. One of the great joys of his life was that he was named to be the first authorized biographer of his, great friend and person he admired so much in Merton. and he loved the opportunity. And one of the things he did, he jokingly called it his monk like me period, because he got to live for weeks at a time in Merton's Hermitage. And very much, we spoke before about Griffin's great gift of empathy. Well, he, much like he tried to enter into what a black man might experience, he tried to enter as deeply as he could into what Merton was experiencing. So I think that was just a real gift for him, that time that he got to spend at Gethsemane, the friendships he made there. But then, unfortunately, Griffin's health was just very poor. It really got in the way of his completing this assignment, and you know, about halfway through it, he had to essentially give the assignment back to the book company.
And this was a real financial issue for him too, because as you note, he would take these great risks in his life, but it was not always. He didn't know what the financial outcome would be, and often didn't always engage in contracts that were to his benefit.
Yes, unfortunately, Griffin was not a very astute businessman. Like a lot of artists, he did things for the artistic challenge, the artistic opportunity, and didn't always read the fine print. For example, his book, Black Like Me, I think to date has sold 12 million copies, and someone would think, gee, he probably did very well off that. Well, whether it was you know, done intentionally or not, his publisher worked the deal in such a way that Griffin made some money for a few years, but the people that really reaped the most economic benefits was the publishing company. And so Griffin just took things on their artistic merit as opposed to what would really help his bottom line. And while that enriched his life probably artistically, or no doubt about it artistically, he died virtually penniless.
Now maybe we can talk one last time about the book and the impact that it had. I mean, perhaps it's not as well known now as it was then, but one of the people you interview in the documentary, Jonathan Yardley, compares it to books like Uncle Tom's Cabin or Grapes of Wrath in that it had a major impact on a social movement.
Yes. When Black Like Me came out, which was in 1961, well, first it came out in 1960 in five different articles that were published in Sepia Magazine, which was the equivalent to old Look Magazine or a very nice magazine that was aimed towards a African-American audience. And then the book itself came out in 61, and it caused quite a sensation because a lot of people just thought, you know, why would anyone do this? I mean, it was, in today's world where there's reality shows that are so common, I mean, you sort of think, oh, gee, what a neat gimmick. Or, but, you know, in 1960, that was not part of the thought process, and Griffin did this without any safety net. And it caused quite a sensation. Martin Luther King said to him, you know, John, this is a really good book, but you know, it's not telling black people anything that they don't already know. And Griffin acknowledged that. He said, you know, that this is a book that is aimed at a white audience that has taken for granted that things are okay, you know, that the status quo is okay. And what Black Like Me did was shake up the status quo. It made a lot of people and a lot of white people question their approach to race. It made them question the status quo. And it came at a time when so many things were changing that many critics have said that it was a real sort of a catalyst for the change that was unfolding at the time.
Well, I just want to end on the last years of his life where you mentioned that he was really had real health problems, including diabetes. And yet, you quote a really compelling sentence that he wrote about the experience of pain and that how he could, you know, if you could suffer without self-pity, you could transform this into a limitless capacity for compassion. I was really struck by that, and, you know, there's something about that that is really quite moving and almost saintly. is there something about him and his story that really can speak to the modern spiritual seeker?
Well, I think Griffin's, though he died in 1980, I think his experiences, both what he was confronting and then his spiritual experiences, are very, well, are timeless. The issues that he confronted, like racism or fear of the other, they're certainly alive today. I mean, we see them in our reaction to Islam and things of that nature, and race is hardly a settled issue. In his spiritual seeking, Griffin was able, through the last 3 or 4 years of his life, in which he was virtually bedridden, to transcend his own suffering, allow it to transform him to even a deeper level spiritually. And he saw, I think he found in those last 3 or 4 years what he had been striving for throughout his life, which was that ultimate empathy with others, that ultimate sense of compassion. And that was, he certainly did not want to die as a relatively young man of 60, but I think in many ways he was fulfilled. You know, one of the last thoughts or the last emotions that he expressed was, you know, that sense of finding that the universality of the human spirit, and that there is no other. You know, that sense of separation from us, from other humans, had completely dropped away for him.
Well, Morgan Atkinson, the writer and director of the documentary Uncommon Vision, The Life and Times of John Howard Griffin, we just want to thank you for spending a few minutes to talk with us.
Thank you, Tim. I enjoyed it.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's America Magazine podcast. A reminder that you can purchase that Morgan Atkinson documentary, Uncommon Vision, at morganatkinson.com. You should also check out our videos this week, where we started our Advent Reflection Series, where each week we'll be posting a video reflection from one of the editors. You can find that on our homepage. A reminder that you can respond to our podcasts at americanmagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.